Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Paul Sinfuegos. Paul Sinfuegos is a national leader in the community rights movement, which works to dismantle corporate constitutional so-called rights and assert the people's inherent right to govern themselves. He's been leading workshops across the U.S. since 1995. David Barsamian's internationally syndicated show Alternative Radio has broadcast five of his speeches. Launched in October 2017, Paul is the founding director of Community Rights US. He lives in Portland, Oregon. There's more info at www.communityrights.us. And so first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
It is a real pleasure to be with you, Derek.
So I know this is going to embarrass you a little bit, but back when I was a baby activist, 1989, 90, 91, there were people who spoke of your work with hushed tones. There was all these rumors of this guy who just does this amazing work for community rights and for democracy and against corporate ownership, corporate rule, really. And I don't remember the very first time we met, but I remember the feeling I had when I did meet you, which is that I was meeting somebody who had done some really important work and who was doing really important work. And I was pretty much in awe. I just want to, I know that's kind of embarrassing probably from your perspective, but I just wanted to get that out there. So having said that, you have your first book coming out, and there are two things I would like to really cover today. One is just your experience, your history of activism, and your wisdom of having of being an elder in our movement, even though you're only 2 years older than I am, but you started younger. And the other is your book, which is called How Dare We? Courageous Practices to Reclaim Our Power as Citizens. So do you want to start with the wisdom of the elder, or do you want to start with the How Dare We?
I'll start with How Dare We, the book.
Okay, great. So tell us about the book.
So the book is a compilation of literally dozens of essays and speeches that I've given over decades. And it's something that people have been nudging me to write for more than a decade. And I think probably because I'm so ADD, it's taken me this long to get it out. But it was not that big a challenge to do it because it was mostly written material. And I'm working with just a wonderful publisher, a one-woman publishing house, Little Big Bay in Mellon, Wisconsin, which is a town of a couple hundred people. Someone who came to my weekend training in Ashland, Wisconsin years ago and was so enamored by the workshop that she came up to me afterwards and said, if you ever write a book, get in touch. Here's my card. So that was kind of a fun beginning for the book idea. I have been years before, like I've been doing community rights organizing and teaching for something like 2.5 decades at this point. But even before that, I was working in a whole variety of social movements, protecting ancient forests, working with Friends of Clackwit Sound up on Vancouver Island, Canada, native sovereignty work, anti-nuclear power, nonviolent direct action trainings, was a workshop leader for anti-Trident submarine actions in the late 70s in my early college days, up in Bangor, Washington, as they were building a Trident nuclear submarine base, the most dangerous nuclear weapon ever created. And all of this work appears somewhere in the book. So it's been a lot of fun to pull it all together. And it may be worth mentioning that I lived in Clackwit Sound on the wild west coast of Vancouver Island from 90 to 95 and was part of Friends of Clackwit Sound. And it was in my last few years there after working on a whole variety of single issue campaigns like the ones that I mentioned that I bumped into an essay by Richard Grossman, an excerpt that was excerpted in a copy of Earth Island Journal, which I subscribed to at the time, that said that virtually all of the activism that was going on against corporate power was merely a symptom of corporate rule. And it was this enormous aha moment for me in the early 90s to realize that my anti-nuclear power and nuclear weapons work and my clear-cut logging opposition work and so much of the other single-issue stuff I'd done had merely been a symptom of corporate rule, and that the problem wasn't that corporations clear-cut. The problem was we, the people, allowed corporations to have decision-making authority to clear-cut. And the same on nuclear power, and the same on nuclear weapons, and the same on healthcare policy, and the same on agricultural policy and foreign affairs, and on and on and on, energy policy. That the problem has been for decades, for many, many decades, that we, the people, the sovereign people, who have ultimate governing authority over our institutions, be they government or corporate, that we, the people, have the authority, but we don't know we do, and so we don't use it, to define what corporations are allowed to do and be, not just to regulate them around the edges. And so in those latter days in Clackwood Sound, Vancouver Island, my entire world was kind of turned upside down. And I got involved in the community rights movement in 94, 95. And really, my life hasn't been the same since. And so this book is a compilation of some of the pre-community rights activism authoring work that I've done, but it's probably two-thirds essays and speeches that I've given about reining in corporate constitutional rights and corporate personhood, which has really been since like 1995, I think, 05, 15, gosh. So what is that, 20? My math is not working in my head right now. What's 95 to the present? 05, 15. 27 years. Yeah. So that's been like almost everything. I've been doing this one thing now for 26, 27 years.
So I'm going to do a couple things. One of them is I'm going to read a couple of the titles of some of the essays, and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to ask you, that's great that you say we have this power, but what does that mean? So a couple of the titles of some of the pieces in it: all power is inherent in the people, but only if we act as if we believe it. Our government does a service by design. Got property rights. You have the right to destroy planet Earth. The right of local self-government. This is what democracy actually looks like. Common sense rules for controlling corporations. So either take any one of those and talk about it, or talk about how what that looks like or means to say that we actually have the power over corporations and governments.
No problem. And we have, what, 43 hours to have this conversation?
Yeah, well, the rest of our lives.
Okay. So I think I'll tackle the "our government doesn't serve us by design" just as a starter place. So the American Revolution was obviously a very complicated thing, but there were actually a lot of people in the American Revolution who believed that the primary purpose was to create the right of local self-government at the local level, that which really is true democratic participatory structures. But very quickly after the American Revolution, the American Revolution created a constitution that most of us have never even heard of, called the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. And that was supposed to be our constitution long term. And in that constitution, there were all sorts of things that were incredibly democratic compared to the present time, such as there were no standing courts at all, so clearly no Supreme Court. There was no executive branch, i.e. the president. There was no U.S. Senate, which is kind of like the British House of Lords. It's the Millionaires Club, and on and on. And power was real power was at the state level. The feds did not have a lot of power. States came together to talk to each other about things to facilitate and coordinate. But real power was state, and local governments had real decision-making authority. That did not work for those among the so-called founding fathers who wanted to build the new empire in the so-called New World and trample the people who were here, obviously, in mass genocide. And they proceeded within the first decade of our first constitution to illegally overthrow the constitution and create what we now call the constitution. That's our second constitution, where all of a sudden local and state power no longer has real authority and it's all in federal hands. And we have a judiciary that overrules the people and the people's house. And we have an executive branch that overrules the public and on and on. And so that's kind of the early and kind of jumping. I mean, that was quite a lot to bite off in just a couple of moments. But that's kind of the beginning, is a real controversy between our so-called founding fathers who want real democracy and those who want empire. And if you fast forward not that many decades past that, the country has now been carved up and there's now 13 colonies, and all of them are, it turns out, crown corporations of a monarch overseas, a British or a French monarch. So we end up with 13 crown corporations that are controlled by a monarch in Europe. And the American Revolution is about throwing that off. But I jumped backwards instead of forwards. If you jump forwards a bunch of decades after the United States is clearly an empire, in the late 1800s, the corporations, large corporations, were beginning to exist and were beginning to have a lot of political power. They were getting incredibly rich, selling munitions and uniforms, et cetera, to both sides of the Civil War. And the Industrial Revolution was starting to take off. And so businesses were starting to be very powerful. And at that point, corporations had no political authority whatsoever. They had no participation in the political process, in the body politic. And that was no longer going to work for corporate leaders. And so in the 1880s, corporate leaders decided to start working through the federal courts, specifically the Supreme Court, to start packing the rights of people into the corporate form. And so you have, starting in 1819 and going all the way through the 1800s, the corporate leaders convinced the U.S. Supreme Court, which has always been on the side of the elite from day one, contrary to public opinion, public notion, they convinced the Supreme Court to start recognizing corporations as having all sorts of constitutional rights via various clauses in the Constitution. And in 1886, they convinced the Supreme Court that the word person in the Constitution includes business corporations. And so what we say in our movement is that we've never actually had a democratic republic in the United States, that we moved from a slave society to a corporate rule society. We've never had majority rule, because prior to the 1880s, white propertied men had legal personhood with rights and legal standing. And from the 1880s on, the primary power has been among the ruling elite, who hide behind the corporate form and have all of their power that way. And so, for example, in a title like All Power is Inherent in the People, my essay, But Only If We Act as If We Believe It, what we the people do not understand is that almost all of the power that corporations have won over the years, they've won through Supreme Court decisions. There's never been a legislative branch decision giving constitutional rights to corporations. And constitutional rights is where virtually all of their power resides. People say, oh, it's because they have so much money, they can bribe politicians, but they're only allowed to give money into the political process because they have First Amendment free speech rights, which the Supreme Court has decided includes money. Money equals speech. And so if you stripped corporations of their so-called corporate personhood and other constitutional rights, what you're left with is what the founders envisioned for corporations, which is that a corporation is merely a subordinate legal entity, a legal fiction. Legal fiction meaning it exists in business language, in law, but it doesn't exist in reality. You cannot take a photograph of Exxon Corporation. It doesn't exist in the real world. And these institutions are to be defined by state legislatures, not regulated around the edges after they've caused all so much harm. And what they're allowed to do and to be is to be defined by state legislatures. How long they're allowed to exist is to be defined by state legislatures. Their charters can be revoked, etc. And so these days we live in a state where all corporate power is regulated rather than defined. And that all started in the late 1800s as well. And now we, the people, don't even understand that we, the sovereign people, have the legal authority, and we always have, to work through our state governments to re-subordinate the corporation, to take away its decision-making authority, to take away its property rights, to take away its capacity to be involved in the political process through lobbying and campaign donations, etc. And instead, we the people have become so colonized that we think that our power is voting with our dollars as consumers or attending regulatory hearings where we beg appointed regulators from these alphabet soup of regulatory agencies to please stop the latest corporate harmful activity, rather than saying we the people are going to set these minimum standards for environmental and labor and sustainability rules, and all corporations have to follow them. And if you don't, you will be dissolved. Your charter will be dissolved. So we say in the community rights movement that the primary problem is that the public doesn't understand its own power and authority. Not that the corporations are Goliaths and we're these tiny Davids trying to pull them down. We're actually the ones with all of the power, but we don't know our own history, and so we don't act on this stuff. And that's what the community rights movement has been trying to teach, and what I've been teaching all over the country now for a few decades. And I have to say, to a large degree, unsuccessfully, this movement has been teaching this work, because the public is so damn colonized that even though I can spend a weekend with existing activists helping them to understand this history, they come out of a weekend workshop incredibly excited, and then they immediately fall back into what they assume is the normal situation where they have no power and authority. And so the movement has not grown in the way that I anticipated that it would over these past decades, which has been obviously a huge disappointment to me.
So I have a few things to say. One of them is that when I used to do a lot of talks around the country, I would routinely ask audiences if the current government takes better care of human beings or corporations. And when I would ask that, everybody would laugh because. And there was not a single person out of all the thousands and thousands of people, there was not a single person ever who said that the federal government takes better care of human beings and corporations. Everybody said it. So we all recognize that the government serves them. That's one thing. Another thing is, I'm thinking of a political cartoon that I once saw where there's this corporation is standing up to bat in a baseball game, and the pitcher throws in a strike, and the umpire says, strike 7,450. And then the person just stands there, you know, because the corporation can have all these strikes, but never gets thrown out. Right. And then the third thing is, another of your essays is called Taking Our Language Back from Corporate Culture. And am I wrong, or is part of the decolonization process that taking the language back. And what do you mean by that?
Yes, you're absolutely right. That is part of the decolonization process. I wish that I had pulled that particular essay out in front of me so that I could do a better job of quoting from it, because as I was concerned might happen, I'm kind of going blank with examples. But I'll just give you just one example that comes to mind, which is what we now call organic food. Up until the 1950s, we would have called quote unquote food. That it wasn't until the 1950s that all of these petrochemical fertilizers and additives and pesticides, et cetera, flavorings, colorings, started happening. And so what would it look like if instead of grocery stores having a section called organic food, it simply said food or produce, and the section that just was produce was called poisoned produce? I mean, that's just one of, you know, so many examples. Another example is the people who have started micro radio stations over the decades to try to have some basic kind of democracy on our public airwaves. Why in the hell do citizens call their own independent radio stations pirate radio when the airwaves are literally owned by we the people? The U.S. airwaves, radio and TV airwaves, they're not owned by the government. The way the law is set up, they're owned by we the people. And yet we're pirates stealing our airwaves, right? Or mainstream media. Why are MSNBC and CBS and Fox, why are they considered mainstream media? And Democracy Now! Or Crystal and Sagar's show Breaking Points considered alternative media, right? I mean, these are examples of our language being stolen away from us. But there's a whole essay in the book about this with a ton of examples.
So I hear what you're saying about us having power, but that – oh, and I also loved what you said about how this all happened through the courts, because when you were saying that, I was thinking, can you imagine if they put to a direct vote of the people, should corporations have more rights than human beings, or should corporations be treated better than human beings? That would get voted down 95-5.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But so given that everything you're saying is true, and given that everybody understands that the current regime takes better care of corporations than humans, much less non-humans, but given also the fact that the court system has declared, given what we face, what do we do? How do we actualize the power that we actually have?
Well, so the court system is a subordinate government institution. So the court system, like the executive, like the legislative branches, are we the people's subordinate. Government constitutionally is required to serve us. It has duties and responsibilities to us. That includes the judiciary. When there is not consent of the governed, say all of our founding documents, both state and federal, government is no longer functioning legitimately, at which point we the people have all sorts of authority to assert our power or even to abolish the government. I mean,
that's the Declaration of Independence.
What's that?
That's the Declaration of Independence, too.
Yes, and it's in the preamble of the federal constitution, and it tends to be the first paragraph of every state constitution, and on and on. In fact, Abraham Lincoln, in his inaugural address, in his first hour as president of the United States, he reminded the public that we the people have the right to abolish the government when we see fit. Can you imagine a president being that brave in his first hour as president? It's pretty amazing. So, I mean, let me give you an example. So the community rights movement has helped about 200 communities in about a dozen states to pass community rights laws so far. since 1999, when this work started. And each one of those laws makes three assertions. It strips a specific grouping of corporations of all of their constitutional rights, their so-called constitutional rights. It asserts the inherent right of a local community to govern itself and to protect its own health, safety, and welfare, regardless of what state or federal law says. And it bans specific harmful corporate activities like mining, water bottling for profit, pesticides. So what happens next frequently is the corporation that has been stopped, its lawyers go to court and they assert that this is violating the corporation's constitutional rights. And of course, the judges, who are all qualified to challenge these assumed laws, 99% of the time will stand with the corporation and will overrule this community rights law that either the public has passed through the ballot box or the town or city or county council has passed directly. Now, at that point, if we the people understand that the judiciary is required to serve us and has duties and responsibilities to us, it should be clear after we pass the law saying we want this thing banned, this harmful corporate activity banned, the only reason that it's not clear to the public in that community that the judge's decision is simply not acceptable and will not be allowed is that we're so colonized, right? That the judge says this thing, and so we're like, oh, I guess we lost again, and then we go sit on our hands and look for another campaign to get involved with, or we just give up because we're tired of losing. So if our minds were not so colonized, at that point, what we would say to the judge is what they said in the earliest stages of the American Revolution in tiny little villages in Massachusetts, where local community councils started passing resolutions that stopped conceding that the British courts and that the British local governments had any authority and forced these people to resign or they would be run out of town, right? And virtually all of this was done without a single shot being fired. So what would it look like if in a town where the judge has just overruled a community rights local ordinance, that the community says, excuse me, judge, whether it be a full page ad in the newspaper or a public letter to the judge that's copied and sent to everybody in town, whatever. Excuse us, judge, but you're in error. You required to serve us, and we're now going ahead and enforcing this rule, this law that we've already passed, our local elected officials have already passed, regardless of what you say, because you've proven that you don't actually have legitimacy to protect the health and welfare of our community. Now, in my mind, of course, I've been doing this work for more than two decades. So in my mind, what's so radical about that, right? The public is the sovereign. We have ultimate decision-making authority over all branches of government and business corporations. Why wouldn't we do that? And yet, there hasn't been a single community of the 200 communities in the U.S. that would stand up to the judiciary. Or, here's another example on the climate crisis. The nth meeting is happening in Glasgow, Scotland right now. Thousands and thousands of people are meeting to try to deal with the climate crisis. The largest delegation at the climate talks in Glasgow represents giant corporations. Now, there's 100,000 citizens from all over the world who are marching outside. Now, why aren't those 100,000 citizens shutting down the COP talks, the climate talks? Why aren't they making a series of demands like we once did in Seattle in the streets and successfully shut down the World Trade Organization, the WTO in Seattle many decades ago? I was there. It was an amazing week. Why are we making so-called demands, but there's no power behind our demands, right? It would not be that difficult for the 100,000 people in the streets in Glasgow to shut down the COP summit and say, we will not allow this summit to continue until the corporate representatives are no longer at the table. and here's our other additional demands. And once we have an agreement from all of the nation's leaders, we'll allow the meeting to continue. Like, are we in an emergency or not? If we claim that we're in an emergency, you know, why are we not active? It's like, you know, I gave a speech some years ago, and it's in the book. It's called We the People Standing Together to Protect Our Climate, Lessons from the Community Rights Movement. I had just read Naomi Klein's very fascinating book, This Changes Everything, about the climate emergency. And her analysis was excellent. And like, similar to virtually every so-called thought leader out there, visionary out there in the United States, there was absolutely no solution in this big book on how to deal with the climate emergency, other than the word that I don't know if she invented or just used, blockadia, right? That was her entire solution to the climate emergency, was major blockades by the public. So I wrote this speech and I gave all sorts of examples of what local communities, the entire speech quotes from her book extensively. It's one of the speeches that alternative radio played nationally. There's a list at the end of the speech of dozens of ideas that a local community could pass immediately that would start to draw down our fossil fuel use immediately. And, you know, rather than waiting for the federal government or the international organizations to do what we the people, I think, know they're not capable of doing, because why are we not using local power, which we still do have control over? In most communities, we can overrule corporate interests at the local level, and yet we don't. And I would call that a colonized mind. That's Naomi Klein's colonized thinking. That's the 100,000 people in the streets in Glasgow's colonized thinking. This stuff is thick. It's just embedded into our brains, and it's really hard to overcome.
I'm thinking about a couple things. One of them is many years ago, before California legalized marijuana, but after Prop 215 legalized medical marijuana, it was up to counties to determine how many plants a person could have. And the county where I live had said a person can have up to 99 plants, and the Board of Supervisors were going to reduce it to 6. And it was one of the most glorious examples. I actually went to the meeting. It was one of the most glorious examples I've ever seen of participatory democracy, because had the Board of Supervisors reduced it from 99 to 6, they would not have left the building. The place was absolutely packed. So that was the good thing, is that's participatory democracy in all of its messiness. The bad thing was that it broke my heart, because this was about marijuana and not about salmon or other things. And the reason I bring that up, and the reason I like to use that example, is because a lot of times, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but we can have a discussion or not, whatever you want. A lot of times when people care enough, they drop that colonized attitude and they know what to do. All the people knew what to do. They just packed the place. You could barely breathe. The place was so filled. And again, it was because of something that they cared about so much.
Yeah.
And I just fear, and this is part of the decolonization or colonization process, is that I fear that we don't, that there are other issues about which we simply do not care enough. Do you agree with that? Do you disagree?
I think that there are lots of issues that people don't care enough about, but I think that we have to look at those in the context of they don't know how to participate to make a difference. And so they go numb to some degree around their level of caring because it feels hopeless and they feel powerless. And like I have said in my workshops for decades now, and people are just aghast when I say it, that I've never met an apathetic person. And I really mean that. You know, activists are just infamous for just writing off the vast swath of the public as apathetic. My perspective is that people care to the extent that they have some power to make a difference on around that topic. And for most people who have attempted to participate, even at the most basic level, like showing up at a city council meeting or writing a letter to their elected officials and getting basically no response, right? No, there's almost no cause and effect response when a member of the public tries to participate. And so, in my opinion, it becomes an absolutely rational response to disconnect from the political process entirely after repeatedly hitting your head against the wall and getting nothing in response. So when I think about the salmon issue, it's the same thing. It's like, how would I protect salmon? How would I organize to take out a major dam? And if I can't figure that out, I disconnect to some degree from that issue. And I don't think that makes me apathetic. I think it makes me feel hopeless and powerless.
You know, that's such a great example. And the when I was about to interrupt you a moment ago, it was interesting because it was about salmon and dams that I suddenly remembered a big public input so-called meeting having to do with the Bonneville Power Commission or whatever, the Power Planning Commission, and all the stakeholders. And it was pretty cool. I was a very young and brash activist at the point, and they were taking public input. And at one point I said, look, these dams need to come down. We all know it. And if you are not going to take them down, you, a Power Planning Commission, we in our community are going to do it. We need to take these out. And the place went crazy. And then it was so fun after that. So many people came up and they simply said, I support the Jensen alternative. And the point is that didn't even make it. That went nowhere. Obviously, the dams are still up. And so it's so true what you say about we can go in and we have these solutions that we present. And then what's the line? I can't remember who says it, but she has this great line about how it's a democracy theme park where we can speak into the microphones, but they're not actually connected to anything. And we can flip the levers, but they're not connected to anything. And it's all just an amusement park ride.
That's Jane Ann Morris, who was one of my primary mentors in my learning about how to lead this work.
I love that. I love that paragraph so much.
Yeah. And she has an amazing website called democracythemepark.org. Very worth looking at.
So how do we, I love what you're saying. And I think that listeners are learning why all that 25 and 30 years ago, people were speaking about you in hushed tones, which is the way you're talking here. This is so great. But how do we move? I love what you say about not being apathetic. And instead, you know, what's that thing about the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again, expecting something different to happen?
Yeah.
You know, you and I have, I'm sure, given our public input at a bazillion meetings, and, you know, the world's still getting killed.
Well, and as you may recall, this is why I said to you a while ago that I want to have a long conversation with you about how we take down one of the Columbia River dams to start helping the salmon from going extinct. Because I think we each have, you know, a unique perspective that's, you know, each of our perspectives, I think, is very different. But I would just love the opportunity to pull a kind of a community rights analysis into your passion and mine as well about saving the salmon. I really want to do that with you one of these days.
Well, let's set up another time for that.
I would love
that. In the meantime, and we have, I don't know, 10, 12, 14 minutes left. So it's not time to wind down yet, but I'm just telling you. So how do we, given that we live in this democracy theme park on one hand, and given also that the power does reside in us, and given that so many people, and I have to say another thing too, which is I'm just thinking about the woman who was speaking at a school board meeting recently about some of the horrific sex ed material that was in the library, which was extremely graphic stuff. She started reading from it, and they cut off our microphones saying, "You can't read this. There are children present." And that was just a beautiful example of, you know, they cut off her mic. And so how do we get from point A of democracy theme park, people not being apathetic, but being disillusioned or whatever word we want to use, to people recognizing they have this power and standing up and doing what the pre-revolutionary citizens, activists, whatever you want to call them, did back then? How do we get from point A to point B? And point B, by the way, is not having community rights. Point B is moving the struggle toward community rights into a more sort of fevered pitch.
Oh, that's all that point B is.
Yeah, that's all the point B is. Point C is after the community rights have been put in place.
It's real but democracy.
We're not, yeah, real democracy. But we're not even talking about that yet. We're just going to talk about getting from the point where we are to the point where we don't beg but demand.
Right.
Is that the way to say it?
You know what? It isn't. It is not the way to say it, because to demand is to still be outside of decision-making authority.
Great. Thank you.
It's to instruct. The proper verb of we the people and our talking to our elected officials is to instruct them. They're our subordinates. How do we get from A to B? You know, I've been trying to figure this out as well, Derek, forever. And this is why I shared earlier that I'm feeling somewhat disillusioned, because I've been leading introductory workshops and weekend trainings on building community rights structures at the local level for more than two decades now. And the movement is growing just so incredibly slowly. And when I've tried to reach out to thought leaders, I've gotten nowhere. I've written letters to so many of our so-called national thought leaders around this and gone nowhere. Sunrise Movement and other youth movements around climate change, with my climate speech analysis, thinking, you know, the community rights movement would love to be in service to y'all. And because I can't imagine a group that would be better motivated at this point to be either organizing local ballot initiatives where they live or putting pressure on local elected officials than to pass radical climate centered community rights ordinances, locally enforceable ordinances. I haven't been able to get any kind of resonance from youth climate movement activists. I've reached out over decades to so many of these groups, and I'm really at a loss. I am at a loss. I mean, one of the things that's been missing, of course, is, you know, like my organization, Community Rights US, that I'm realizing I haven't even mentioned in this whole hour. I'd love people to go check our work out at www.communityrights.us. We're a four-year-old organization whose capacity is incredibly limited because our funding is so limited, right? It's incredibly hard to get funding to do work that challenges corporate rights and corporate rule. And so I'm just not sure how to move forward. And that's, boy, is that a vague response.
Well, I think it's an honest response. And I think that this is part of the problem that we all face. And I wonder, you know, Lewis Mumford talked about what he called the magnificent bribe, which is, he asked, how is it that so many of us have given up every vestige of democracy and given everything over to what he calls the mega machine, that is converting the entire planet into machines, this is one of the questions that started my work in the first place, is this isn't even making us happy. Why are we doing all this? You know? And Mumford's answer, at least, is that the Mega Machine gives a significant portion of us a promise of a significant portion of the goodies. And by doing that, it bribes us to that we will only accept what the machine gives us, and if we don't ask for anything else. And so we take it. So we get 27 brands of toothpaste, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I'm going to go a different direction here and say the same thing. Years ago, I was at a conference with Wes Jackson. And one of the offhand comments he made at one point was that Walmart and cheap consumer goods, cheap diapers is what he said, is what is keeping the United States from rebellion. And his implication was that as long as we have access to cheap consumer goods, we will remain somewhat pacified. Mm-hmm. And I'm just rambling. I mean, I'm throwing this in as one of the possibilities too for how this movement grows so slowly is because the system itself is still chugging along.
Brilliant. The system is that. I mean, corporate capitalism is absolutely brilliant. The hierarchical nature of virtually every relationship, you know, just locks us all in. I think maybe one of the most hopeful things that I can think of in response to what you just said is what's being called the Great Resignation, that tens of millions of people in this country have quit their jobs in the last few months and are rethinking what the purpose of their lives are. Have you thought about that at all in terms of, like, you know, a small, you know, ratcheting down of this crisis?
I have thought about it, but I have not thought about it to a degree where I have something remarkable to say.
It's just you literally got 10. I mean, it's tens of millions of people in the United States, and a lot of them, you know, in their first and second significant lifelong career jobs, you know, decent paying, massive career opportunity jobs, have quit and are reevaluating what their lives are going to be for. And, you know, when we're so on the treadmill in this country, probably more than any other, for more. There has to be something really powerful there, and it occurs to me, I hadn't thought about this before, that perhaps that should be a primary target audience of our community rights movement's outreach work.
Yeah, I like that. And, you know, this actually reminds me of another thing, that it's something that I used to say a lot to people when they would ask me, so how do we approach people? I would always say, everybody's different. And the example I would give is, when I would go into the local computer store that no longer exists because it was driven out of business by Walmart, when I would go into the local computer repair shop, I would never say, gosh, they're killing salmon, because the guy didn't really care about salmon. What I would talk about is the effect of big box stores on small businesses, because he cared about that. So the point is, I think that one of the ways to – this is hard work because it's done individually – but one of the ways to move people from their state of having been discouraged by having been beaten against the wall is to find the wedges, to find the places where.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Take it.
No, I'm just saying, I'm just agreeing. Carry on. I didn't have a particular thing to say.
OK, to find the places where they are dissatisfied with the system.
Yeah.
And. Oh, one more example of that, and then I'm going to let you just wrap up. One more example of that, I was giving a talk one time, and this would happen, that I give a talk about nature, and I always hated it when teachers would make students come to the talk, because they don't want to be there, and so they're not really interested. And a lot of times when that would happen, I'm talking about the murder of the planet, and I can just tell they don't care. So it's like, okay, I got a plan B. And, you know, I talk about something else and try to get them interested and talk about something else. And I remember one time I was doing a talk somewhere in the Midwest. A bunch of students don't want to be there. They're all on their cell phones. And they don't care about anything. I try like four or five topics. And finally I go, okay, I know what I'm going to talk about, which is when I was in college, I had this habit of asking people if they like their jobs. About 90% say no. And what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? What does it mean that when you get out of here, you're going to have to get a job for 40 years that you may not like? Oh my gosh. Suddenly they looked up from their cell phones because this was something that they were thinking about themselves every moment of every day sitting in class.
Right.
So the point is just go to them. But you know that already.
Yeah. I mean, you have to speak to somebody from their own, you know, in a place that touches on their own experience. Absolutely. You know, and that's why I wait, you know, I wait to be invited to a community because a community is battling a particular corporate harm. And they've heard through the grapevine that there might be a more powerful strategy out there other than, you know, begging regulatory leaders. What occurs to me from what you're saying, and I guess, you know, I guess this will be my last comment, is that the way that most activism is framed, it's single issue emergency response activism, right? A community finds out that they're going to get a toxic waste incinerator or a, you know, chemical refinery or a, you know, factory farm in their community, and they mobilize yet another underfunded, you know, understaffed single issue emergency response group, you know, community against the whatever, or friends of the whatever river or whatever. And so everything's organized around what are we trying to stop? And what we're trying to do in our work is to try to get people to think much more imaginatively in terms of accessing their own power. So for us, the transition goes from what are we trying to stop to what do we think we can get to what do we actually want. And if I can help a group over a weekend workshop understand how significant it is to stay focused on what do we actually want, if we are indeed the sovereign people, if we do indeed have governing authority over our business and government, what is it that we actually want? Which is why it's so shocking to me that even the teen and 20 climate activists out there are not accessing what they actually know that they want and need. Where was I going to go with this? I forgot what the last little piece was. Oh, darn.
Well, let me say one thing, which is that I think part of the reason that we get confused about what we want has to do with the bribe I talked about earlier, which is we do want community rights, but we also want the cheap Chinese goodies.
That's right.
Yeah. But that's a terrible note to end on. So you say something else.
Well, I want to encourage people to check out my book. Again, the title is How Dare We? Courageous Practices to Reclaim Our Power as Citizens. And I will guarantee you that if you decide to buy this book or find it in the library and read the whole book, you're going to be a different human being by the end of this 180, 190 page book. It's not going to be that long. It's actually a lot of fun to read. It's full of dozens of short essays, so you don't have to get too buried in a particular topic. It will help you to decolonize your own mind. And at that point, I think I want to turn the book into some kind of set up a study guide for people who can do it together, because I think one of the problems, you know, in our consumer culture is that we're so damn isolated as well from each other. And so just getting people in conversation, into reflective, provocative conversation, I think is so important about this stuff. So I really want to encourage people to check out our organization. I'm the founding director of a group called Community Rights US, and our website is www.communityrights.us, and you'll find information about the book on our homepage. What else, Derek?
Well, I think that's enough. We're running out of time. And so I would like to thank you for your decades of work. And I would like to thank you for being on the program. And I would love to have you back. And also, I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Paul Sinfuegos. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.